Hi to all my friends on my favorite podcast, Two Geeks and a Microphone. May the 4th be with you and all of you.
Hey, Star Wars fans, Jimmy Mack here with you. May the 4th be with you from Rebel Force Radio and Two Geeks and a Microphone.
Hey, this is Jason Swank from Rebel Force Radio, wishing all the listeners of Two Geeks and a Microphone the happiest May the 4th ever. May the 4th be with you always.
Hey, this is Dominic Pace, who plays Gecko the Bounty Hunter from The Mandalorian, wishing a very happy May the 4th to everyone who listens to Two Geeks and a Microphone. All the best to everyone, and may the Force be with you.
Hello there. This is Chris Macht, host of Macht Tales from the Cantina, and the filmmaker that brought you The Force Among Us, The Force Within Us, and the real fans of the saga. You are listening to Two Geeks and a Microphone. I'm not really sure why we need a holiday to emphasize our love of Star Wars. Star Wars should be every day, especially on May 25th. But today, we're celebrating May the 4th, and may the 4th be with you.
Welcome to the Two Geeks and a Microphone podcast, your one-stop shop for television, movie, video games, comic books, book reviews, and more. Now, without further ado, here's Steven and Mike. And hey, everybody, welcome to the Two Geeks and a Microphone podcast. We are so glad that you are here with us today and with a special May the 4th be with you. We got some conversations about that coming up. Yay! I am Stephen Buster, along with my good buddy Michael Shanks, and we are here virtual coffee table today, and we have yet another awesome special guest with us today. Mike, would you like to introduce our guest for us?
Oh my gosh, this is going to be really cool. So we've had one other Star Wars actor on the podcast, and today we're bringing a second one on. Joining us, he played a stormtrooper, a snowtrooper, and an imperial trooper. Please welcome Alan Fling. Thank you, Alan. Yay. Hey, welcome. Yay.
Hi, Mike. Nice to meet you virtually.
Right. It's great to meet you as well. We are so glad you're with us today. So to be open, Alan, when Mike first said, hey, I've got Alan Fling coming on, and I'm like,
Who's Alan Fling?
Because he's the bigger nerdy Star Wars, knows all the details. I love the movies. And then he described your role, and I'll have you describe and talk about your role in Return of the Jedi. And why don't you tell everybody just if they want to see who you are in the film, what is that scene? Now, I do know it's at 1 hour, 58 minutes and 58 seconds in.
Well, let's not be too exact about it.
Right.
I'm on the bridge of the Executor, and Admiral Pete is standing up on the high walk by the windows, looking out. And there's other officers saying, whatever he's saying, but I interrupt them. I come out with this line. I suddenly wheel around. I'm down in the pit. I look up at Admiral Pete and I say, sir, we've lost our bridge deflector shields. Then the conversation follows on. Intensify the forward battery. I don't want anything to get through. Too late. Boom. And then the A-wing comes smashing through the vitrine glass and everybody dies.
That's it. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. I kept on trying to tell everybody I must have dived into a some sort of life buoy or something, and I'd floated off into space so I could reappear some other time. So I knew nothing about this when I took on the role. I'll talk about that later if you like. It was unexpected. I wasn't even supposed to be there for this.
Were you
just in that film?
No, I was in The Empire Strikes Back, first of all, which I was supposed to go in for a couple of days, which is what my agent told me he was sending me down for, because I was already appearing in two other films and I was in continuity in them. Therefore, I couldn't change my appearance. He said, well, you can go and do this because they put helmets on you and they won't see your face. So, you know, it's easy money for a couple of days. You know, just fill in this gap and I get my commission.
Yeah.
7.5 weeks later, I escaped the set finally. And the two other films had wrapped. One of them had cut me out of their film. And the other one had to set up a new second unit just to shoot me and finish my scenes off. So
wow.
I was not very popular. And come Return of the Jedi, I had literally walked into Elstree Studios to sign my contract for a film I was starting on the next day.
Oh, wow.
In Wales. And I was the assistant costume designer on the film.
Oh,
so okay. I was going in just to sign up and get my per diems and bit of float money so I could buzz off to Wales. And on my way out of the studio, I got collared by the first AD who was standing outside smoking like a drain, as if the end of the world was coming. And he recognized me, said, Alan, come over here. So I sort of looked at him and I thought, oh, this doesn't look good. So I went to him and he said, you need to do me a favor. I said, a favor? Me do you a favor? I'm on my way on to my next film. You know, I'm just here to sign a contract. That's all. He said, no, you've got to do me a favor. We've had an actor here all morning. We've been trying to shoot on him. And it wasn't until he came in and he put on the uniform that was made to measure for him after he went into Western Costumes in LA, who then faxed all his measures over to Berman's and Nathan's in London, who then made the costume for him. And he arrived here with his agent and various blah, 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 blah. Turns out he had a terrible stutter.
Could not get
the line out.
Oh, no.
So by the time I walked past the door, the barn door of the studio, which was open at the time, they were getting a bit desperate because they'd retired him to his room, taken his costume off, which was soaking wet with perspiration.
Oh, Lord.
And
man.
They said, we just want you to put on an outfit and go in front of the camera. There's only one line. We know you can do it. I said, well, as long as it is that quick.
So wait, you had to wear his sweaty uniform then?
Yeah. I went to the wardrobe. I hadn't tried to dry it at all. It was still absolutely wringing wet.
Oh, my gosh.
Nervous perspiration, which I have to tell you, buffalo hide. It's disgusting. And they held it up for me. I said, I'm never going to get in that. I'll never get in that. For years, I'd been building my body up, and I was quite shapely in those days. I even used to train in the same gym as Prowse.
Oh, really? Prowse. Oh, wow.
In a gym in the Old Kent Road in South London, above a pub, and it was owned by, a boxer who's Henry Cooper, yes.
Interesting.
And we trained there at the same time.
Oh, wow.
So I knew him already. Wow. I knew him from the days when he did the Green Cross Code Man and blah, blah,
right.
Blah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
okay.
Cool. I've heard stories about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we caught up on The Empire Strikes Back. Me nice. Turning up on this film didn't mean I was going to meet up with Prowse. I didn't even know who was in the scene because they didn't give me the script or anything.
Sure.
Just for one line. They just repeated it to me and told me, just keep on saying it, just keep on saying it. And then the sound people who are way back in the studio say, turn it up, louder, louder. We'll get a wild track, louder.
So wait, you didn't even get a scene with...
It's going to be a feature and it's going to be a one-shot on him. So no, we don't want a wild track. You don't need
Gotcha. Gotcha.
So I tried on this outfit and they squeezed me into it, literally squeezed me into it. And the net result was that it was sort of gaping all the way down the side where the hooks were just catching and everything was creaking, not because of the sweat, but it was so damn tight. It was like a second skin.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, this is going to work. I said this to the wardrobe guys who I knew anyway. And I said, no, you've got to do it. Now you're here. You've got to do it. So I went to the stage. And they showed me into this well where these technicians were pushing buttons, you know, illuminating everything. Nothing worked.
Right.
And I said, there's a mark there. This is the guy's mark that you're replacing. You just stand there, look over the shoulder of the guy who's pressing these buttons, and then on action, wheel on a dime and face up into camera and deliver your line nice and loud and with desperation in your voice. I went, well, you're going to have a problem because I can't lean over. I can't do anything.
You can't camera. Move. Oh,
right, right.
I take a deep breath. I can hear stitches popping already.
Oh, no.
In by my side. I couldn't lift my arms like this.
So, ridiculous. So you look like a T-Rex.
I did. I looked absolutely ridiculous. And I said, well, we'll try it anyway. I said, okay, well, I'll do my best. So I sort of craned my neck and tried to look over the guy's shoulder. And it was action. And I wheeled around on 6 months and did the one thing I should never have done, which was take a very deep breath. Oh. So I could shout out this line, which I did. And the back of the jacket split from top to bottom.
Oh, no!
A very loud farting sound, which was over my line as I said it.
Oh, no!
So we got that done, and they said, we'll need to go again. I said, well, there's a problem. We can't go again straight away unless we change my action. I'm already facing that direction. And I turned around and showed them, and I went, oh,
just right. Word.
Just interpolate words that you think I might have said would be right.
And, insert curse here, right?
Right.
So they said, well, we're going to have to go with it. So then they said, we'll check the gate. And being film buffs, you know all about the operation of 35mm cameras. checking the gate usually is an invitation to the focus puller. If he's screwed up, say, there's a hair in the gate.
Oh,
there's a hair in the gate. We have to go again.
Oh,
well, he came out with the line, oh, there's a hair in the gates. And I looked at him, I said, really? And the director looked at me and then looked at the focus, but he said, no, I was slightly out of focus. I said, thought so. We should have rehearsed it first, I suppose. But nevertheless, we can't do it again, not unless you book me for another day. So we can't do that. We've got to move on.
Right.
We're near the end of shooting this film now. This was on the 9th of February, 1982, by the way.
Okay.
So they said, oh, well, we'll just have to work with what we've got. Sound, have you got it? No, because there's this horrendous rending, tearing sound over the toilet. Well, can you clean it up? He said, well, they'll have to pay me an awful lot of money. I said, well, that's not the question. Can you clean it up? And the director's looking at me because I'm putting all these questions that he should be asking, really. You know, I'm an actor that's moved in from nowhere, and all of a sudden I'm playing a role and they've screwed up, not me.
Right.
And he said, well, I suppose we could do something with it. I said, fine. Thanks very much, guys. I've got to go now. I'm supposed to be in Wales tomorrow morning. And the actor, Admiral Peat, looked at me. He went... And I looked at him. I thought, that's a very strange reaction. I said goodbye. Right. I said, thanks very much. Goodbye. And I rushed back to the wardrobe as best I could without splitting any more seams. And they fought me out of the costume. Oh. Literally fought me out of
it. Oh, my gosh. You know, it translated well on the film. It looks like it fits you great in the film.
The desperation was there because I couldn't breathe.
You know, the next time I watch it, I'm going to be looking for things now.
Yeah. Well, if you look on Wikipedia, somebody said about me, I think, in one of the edits, first of all, when it first appeared on Wikipedia, the guy seems to be absolutely desperate. He's got this terribly desperate voice. Well picked up, man. Well picked up.
Awesome.
So I took the costume off, and then they came and grabbed me and said, you've got to go upstairs. They want to see you in the production office. I said, I haven't got the time. I've done what you asked me to. It was a favor. Goodbye. They said, no, you've got to go to the production office. I need to see you. So I then went upstairs to the production office, knew everybody in the production office, said, hi, nice to see you. What are you doing here? What am I doing here? Don't ask. And then they said, well... You need to just knock on that door and go in. And I knocked on the door, and it was George Lucas's office.
Oh, wow.
So I walked in on George Lucas, and he said, I think I've got to thank you. I said, well, no need to thank me. I'm doing a favor. If you like, I'm doing you a favor, but nevertheless, I'm doing you a favor.
Sure.
So nothing to worry about. He said, no, you can't go yet. I've asked you to come up here because you've got to sign a contract. Okay. I said, well, you know, I'm not going to sue you for thousands or millions of pounds. Don't worry about it. He said, no, I've got to have a contract signed by you because you have to assign me the sound of your voice and your appearance on screen. Your rights you have to sign to me are for the world, the whole universe, throughout the entire universe.
Right.
You sign everything over to me. I said, fine. He hadn't got a contract. I said, well, you can write something. He and I had history from Empire Strikes Back. That's another matter. And he wrote something in Biro at the time. And I thought, that's a very strange color for a contract. Nevertheless, he wrote the page and he signed it. And he said, just sign above that and I'll get them to copy it up there. I'll give you this one as your copy and I'll keep the copy. Then we're fine.
Oh, wow.
So I signed this contract. I didn't read it. I thought it was a standard. Well, it was an addition of a standard American contract.
Sure.
So did that, and they came back, and they gave me the original, and he put it into an envelope down low under his desk, and he reached into his drawer and put something else in there. He said, here you are. Thank you very, very much. You've saved me a fortune. There's a little something in there for you. I said, but I've done it for a favor. I don't want to be paid. He said, no, this is for a favor that you've done me. You've saved me a lot of money, but I don't want you to open it in the studio. Wait until you're out on the street, and then you can open it.
Oh, I'm dying.
Okay, so I went downstairs.
So wait, George Lucas just hands you an envelope and tells you that he has a gift for you in it. Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm dying.
I walked out onto the street. Now, Elstree Studios is at one end of a Roman road, which is Elstree, or Boreham Wood. It's the same place. Boreham Wood at one end, Elstree at the other end, but it's all one road, about a mile and a half long, dead straight, typical Roman road. Studios at one end, at the top end, on a roundabout. And at the very, very far end is the railway station, which is where I need to get to. So I get out onto the street. I'm standing just on the roundabout, and I'm looking at this thing. I may as well open it and have a look. And I literally, you know, sometimes when you get a premonition?
Sure, yeah.
I felt I had eyes on me. So I turned around, and the office block I'd just been in was literally beside me or behind me. And I looked up, and half the production office was standing looking out of the window. And George Lucas was looking out of his window, watching me. So I thought, well, this has got to be something special. So I opened it, and I pulled out contract, right, and another piece of paper. And the words that the production secretary told me later when I spoke to her, because I knew her, she said, it was like a scene from a Disney cartoon. You jumped in the air and your legs were cycling before you even hit the ground. And then you started running at top speed. Because there was a check in there that was worth more than I'd earned in 7.5 weeks on Empire Strikes Back.
Wow.
I wasn't in front of the camera more than 30 seconds. And I stood beside the camera for the reverse so that Pete could speak to me. So I had my cheek up against the lens as they put the camera down. And that was my entire involvement in Return of the Jedi. And I was never even supposed to be there. And that formed the major part of my mortgage payment to buy the house I'm sitting in 30 odd years later, or 40 years later now.
Wow.
Right? Wow.
Thank you, George Lucas.
Yeah. Yes, I gave him everything. If you're on Empire Strikes Back, fine, everything's all right.
Wow. I was going to ask you, had you met George Lucas and what your take was of him, but obviously you had a very good experience with George.
Well, with that part, you had a good episode. That's a great story. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Did you?
Empire Strikes Back. I met him on Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
And
okay.
I worked because he decided that he wanted to shoot Second Unit, so I was on the carbonite scene as a stormtrooper.
So now George wasn't on scene in Return when you were filming Return. Okay. Okay.
No, he was upstairs in the office.
Okay.
But on the Empire Strikes Back, he wasn't on the stage either.
Oh.
It was Richard Martin, I think, who was directing.
Okay.
And so George was doing second unit shots. And if I tell you that the man has, I think he's got ADHD or something like that, because he is so
pernickety
about things. Everything has to be perfect with him. He shot more footage on second unit than the first unit for the entire film.
Oh my gosh.
So when I was sent to the second unit off of the Carbonite Chamber set,
nice.
And I did with a couple of others, we had to do shots running up and down this corridor, which was about 50 yards long. And there was a T-section at the end, so it crossed over.
Okay.
And he had run down that way, run back towards camera, down, back, down, back. You could say we were like a metronome doing this. And then we'd have to run across the T-section that way, that way, that way, that way. Keep on doing it. And
gosh.
We did the long run about 30-odd times in quick succession. So you couldn't even get your breath. And I was no runner because I was all muscle in those days. I was gasping for breath. And every time I ran, my helmet was doing that. I was looking into the skin of the side of the helmet.
Right. And now, for those who are listening and not seeing the video, he actually moved his hat like sideways, so the helmet was rotating around you, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, it's oval. It was oval that way, not front to back, side to side. It was oval. it just turned naturally. I had the temerity, because I'm a bit of a big mouth, as you can tell. I had the temerity to go up to George Lucas and do what you were never supposed to do with the director. And I said, "Mr. Lucas, can you tell us what we're doing wrong? And then we can put it right. And most probably you can get what you need." So I said, "So what are we doing wrong?" He said, "No, you're not doing anything wrong." I said, "So how many more times?" He said, "Oh, just keep on doing it until it's right." So we kept on going.
Wait a second. So you're not doing anything wrong, but I want you to keep doing it until you get it right.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
This is George Lucas speak. Or I don't know what I want.
Right.
So and finally I said, "We got it right." He said, "I'll tell you when I know." We got to the end of a saga, and it was a saga of running up and down. We were gasping, we were tripping and falling against the sides, which I presume is what he wanted.
So what scenes was he filming? I'm sorry, what?
Oh, it was general shots of running, of just troopers running down corridors, white corridors, back to the forward.
Okay.
That he would insert. He was a nightmare with those sorts of scenes. He did them all the time.
Okay.
And then he used to go and stick his butt in front of the editor and say, "Out of there," and I'd sit down. He'd start cutting in all the stuff that he shot, which then had to be cut back out again because it made no sense. I told you I'm Mr. Indiscreet and I wasn't joking.
No, I love it. I love it. This is great.
Anyway, we did that and people were bouncing off the walls. And as I said, at the end of it, he turned to the continuity girl and said, "Print number 2. And we had our helmets off by now. And we'd just look at each other going, "What the?"
Right.
We all then had to go off and go back on set. As static stormtroopers standing on top of steaming jets,
uh-huh,
of water coming directly up into our costumes. You didn't need to go to a sauna, I can tell you. I lost weight like you wouldn't believe. And the problem was with that was they always used to shut the barn doors on the stage. No doors were allowed to be opened once they started the jets of steam, because it had to get to a certain temperature. Because until it reached that certain temperature, which was about 110 degrees Fahrenheit,
goodness.
Then the camera, only then the camera could see us, because up till then it was fogged by the steam.
Oh my gosh.
When it got hot enough, then the camera worked and then we could shoot. But that meant nobody could go in or out all the time.
Wow. Dang.
It was as we say in England, it was a bugger of a scene to do. It really was.
I'll bet.
It really was. And similarly, whenever we weren't needed on the first unit set, and we could stand down, as it were, then we were never allowed to relax. We were then shoved back to wardrobe, sent out as snow troopers into the ice tunnels. Guess what? Sea salt on the floor, sea salt sprayed on the walls, and steaming, boiling water venting up all the way through the whole place. And it's coming up inside these wretched costumes with the plastic aprons over the face. It's all going up inside, right, and just sweating and sweating and sweating.
Which happens to be one of my favorite Stormtrooper costumes, by the way.
It was much the same there. It was the same silliness there.
Wow.
And then when I went to see my friend who was one of the editors on it, he said, I've got a shot here of you running as a Hoth rebel. I said, whereabouts? Was it in the hangar? He said, no, you were running down an ice tunnel. I said, oh yeah, I know the one. Where I'm running away from snowtroopers? I said, yeah. I said, let me see it. And he just pulled it up and saw it. And I said, you know who that snowtrooper is that's chasing me? It's me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, look out to your face. Nobody will ever know. I said, fine. All right, fine.
I didn't know that you got to play a rebel trooper too. That's interesting.
Oh yeah, I was a rebel and I was a technician as well.
Oh wow!
So I ended up in the hangar section, toting boxes across the place with Richard Bonehill, who was another one who played the 1001 roles in the film, and we just did whatever we were told to do because we wanted the money.
Well, right, of course, right. Of course. Now, I got to ask you, on the Empire Strikes Back, or on the Carbonite freezing scene, I heard that you were the stormtrooper that got to pull Harrison Ford away. Is that correct?
On one of the takes.
Ah, okay.
And I can't tell you if that's me on the print or whether it's somebody else. Because there's another guy called Alan Austin who suddenly appeared out of the gloom. And I remembered him vaguely from those days. He was a young man, not built like me. He was very, very slim, a teenager. And he now goes around saying, I'm that stormtrooper. That's me in that picture. And what he's done is he's copied all my photos. He signs all my photos as himself.
Oh, no!
Yeah. Isn't that fun? Bless him.
Well, I'll tell you what. Here on our podcast, from now on, we're going to say it was you
I can tell you, I was certainly not doing it entirely for the money, because I have appeared since about 13. I did my first film. We had a foundation here in England, which was set up after the war to make films for children for Saturday morning cinema.
Okay.
And it's called the Children's Film Foundation.
Okay.
And for the Children's Film Foundation, I appeared in almost 250 films.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
impressive.
Yes. So I was doing all of this as a young teenager. I gave it all up. I even went to drama school. I learned to be a real actor. And I went forward and I went and did lots of film. And I appeared in American Werewolf in London.
Oh.
I was in Victoria. As the gay dancer in the club with a guy who came up to hear on me, which they first shot me in drag in a flapper dress, can you believe? And Duke Andrews took one look at me and said, "You've got to be kidding." I said, "I didn't ask. I didn't ask to be dressed like this." Anyway,
wait a minute. What film was that? Like,
Victor Victoria.
I'm going to have to look that up.
I'm going to have to go back and see that again. Yeah.
And lots and lots and lots of films I was in.
Wow.
Oh, dear. I can't even remember the titles of most of them. I was in one with James Cagney at one point.
Oh, wow.
When he was in Stonehenge, bless him. Yeah. I can't remember what that one was, though.
What was your favorite role? What was your favorite role that you did that you remember? I was like, oh, man, this was a great...
I did a film, a really nasty, cheap little film. as you do, as an actor, as you do.
Right.
You got to take the parts to get the money, right?
Yeah, it was made by Canon Films, a highly reputable company.
Okay.
As he should. We're going to have to post the video of this episode.
And I got called to do this thing, and I turned up on set, and I was the only guy there, and I thought, this is very weird. They've not sent me a script. Do I have any lines? What's the action? Have no idea. And then they said, we've got this film going, which is about space vampires, women, naked women who are aliens who are heading towards Earth, and you're an American astronaut who's sent with your partner to try and intercept this comet that they're all inside of. I'm going, yeah, okay.
Okay.
And I said, so what do I do? Well, you get captured. I said, okay. And then what happened? Then they strap you to your own rocket on the outside, and they shoot you back towards Earth, naked.
Oh, boy.
I said, this sounds like a doozy. This one's going to make my name, obviously. And then they took me to the makeup. I had to strip naked. I had to have makeup all over. Give me an American tan, because I was lily white English. And I looked into the next chair, and there's another guy sitting there naked. And I look at him, he looks at me, and I think, I know that face. He looked at me and said, I haven't got a clue who you are. And I introduced myself. He said, oh, I'm Mick Jagger's brother, Chris Jagger.
What?
That's fun. I said, so you've agreed to be naked and strapped to this rocket? He said, yeah. It's a load of crap, but I've got to do it because it's part of the film, you know. Need the money. I said, okay, fine. So we went back naked onto the stage, full crew, about 90 people on the stage.
Wow.
We've got the rocket there and we're strapped. He said, hold on. I don't want to be facing outwards. I want to be facing in. So he wanted to lie on his front. They said, well, one of you's got to lie on your back. I said, well, I suppose that's going to be me, isn't it? I got strapped to the rocket naked. And then it was just rubbish. It was just absolute rubbish. You didn't have green screen even in those days, you know? So space was quite funny because it was a roller blind going backwards and forwards.
Okay, yeah.
About 15 feet high, and they were rolling it around, and then there was prop men behind who were rushing around like this, passing by. It was all so stupid, so surreal. Anyway, I've never nobody's ever asked me for an autograph
for that one.
Yeah, get away with that one. But then I had another film, which was a Quatermass film, and it was yet again the cheapest of cheap. Near to Pinewood Studios, there's a big park called Black Park, which is just rolling hills and a bit of forest and lots of greenery. And this film was going to be shooting there, and it had Sir John Mills in it, various other names. But the script was absolutely diabolical, as usual. And I was cast as what they called a planet person.
Okay.
Planet so person.
They wanted to make up. They said, sit down, getting the oil makeup, you know, two fingers. You're done. Go away.
Real high budget, right?
Yeah, there I was running around all over Black Park with a field of extras following me all the time. I was saying, go away. They're supposed to be following you. I said, oh, great. I love the way they explain these things. So I'd let them on a merry pace in and out of groves and God knows what. People are falling by the wayside and coming out looking like zombies, which is what they're basically supposed to be.
Okay.
And that got me an audition for another film, believe it or not. I thought, well, it can't be any worse than that one, can it?
Right.
I'll have to go onto IMDb to find the name of the film. I've had the credit taken down on nearly all of my acting parts, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Because I became a costume designer and supervisor and a maker, and I had my own So I did 47 films in the costume side of things.
Oh,
which
wow.
Far more illustrious, far more illustrious than what I did in front of the camera. So I had all my acting stuff taken down because producers were saying, I don't want you. I don't want an actor. I want a costume guy. I said, well, I am a costume guy. But you've got all these IMDb credits. I said, that was in the past. That was another lifetime.
So right.
And in the end, I had to have them all removed because I was losing jobs because of it.
Oh, wow.
Huh.
Yeah. So anyway, I got this next job, and I was set in a youth prison, which in England are called borstals. Borstals.
Okay.
So there was a scene that I had to appear in, and guess what they wanted? They wanted a guy naked in the showers. I said, yeah.
They really liked you, didn't they?
Yeah. I said, I'm obviously it. I'm the it boy these days. I was all muscle, and I was all muscly and young. And we were doing this scene, and then this young actor walked in who was younger than me. And I introduced myself, said, hi, I'm Alan. He said, my name's Ray. I said, nice to meet you, Ray. He said, this is my first film. I'm really nervous. I said, well, you know, we've got to be naked in here. He said, oh, they're going to shoot on my back. I said, funny you should say that. I sort of had that feeling. Ray Winston, his first film.
No way.
Oh, wow.
Goodness, a showering in the shower in the borstal, and he's looking at the wall, and I'm looking at the camera. So you wonder why I then left film acting and went. Well, I was making shed load more money.
you're tired of being naked.
So there you go. A very interesting career, not.
Right. Oh my gosh. Alan, I have to say, we've only been doing our podcast for 4 months now, Stephen, and
something like that.
I think this is the hardest I've laughed since.
Wait until we talk about the design jobs I've done. Oh, I've got some Lulus there.
Nice. Right. That's fascinating, though.
So funny.
It's done faces most of the time.
I had no idea this was going to be so funny. This is great.
Well, as I say, I have got this reputation for people ask me a question, I think they deserve an honest answer. So I do. And because I've got that little scintilla of acting skill, which I've still used in later years, but not on film. I've been running my own theatre company for a long time, actually. I was playing Henry VIII and touring around all over with the armed forces, entertaining the troops and God knows what.
Oh, cool.
Doing dinner theatre for them, three-hour shows, all singing, all dancing, all bumptiousness. And I just bounced off the walls on that show, which they loved. You know, I remember doing an American Air Force base here in England, and it was an officer's mess, and they were very, very staid, very, very quiet. I thought, I've got to get them going. So I have this costume which has a very large cod piece. Henry VIII is very well known for his cod piece. It's a huge lump under his waist, sticking straight out at the front. And the women generally just stare, especially if they're polite young ladies. Well, I have to tell you, a lot of drink went down, a lot of gullets that night. And by the time I finished the show, I had the CEO's wife straddling me and jumping up and down on my cob piece.
Oh, my gosh.
Good night, my lords and ladies. Good night. I must ride. Oh, wow. So, I tend to find fun wherever I see it.
So
yeah, excellent.
I got to ask you something, Alan. Have you ever heard of the rock band Kiss?
Yes.
Okay. So I wonder if that's where Gene Simmons got the, because you know Gene wears a big giant cod piece also. So.
Not as big as mine, I can assure you.
Oh no, he's got a visual.
Oh, we got visual.
Oh, Lord.
That's a nice one right there.
Wow.
I have to duck because it's so big.
I have to say, Gene would be proud. You'd make Gene proud.
I was just repairing it because I busted it the other night. There you go.
Oh, my gosh.
You were already doing costuming even when you did the Star Wars films.
Yeah.
Oh.
I knew John Mullow very well. And he was a designer on the first Star Wars, on A New Hope. And mm-hmm. John and I were good friends. I got a call from him saying they need some stuff for the set. I said, well, what is it? Because I had my own workroom set up. I used to manufacture shows for the West End, and I also made costumes for films and TV and whatever.
Gotcha.
Light entertainment. So what he said they needed were black boiler suits and two-piece Imperial officers, black Imperial officers for the Death Star. So I said, that's all right, that's fine. So how many hundreds do you want, and which week do you need them? So I don't know, I think I did about 50 officers, about 150 boiler suits.
Wow.
And they played in all the films under different guises, different extra bits added to them.
How long did it take you to make those 50?
Oh, not long. Not long.
Okay.
I had industrial machines, and industrial machine goes, you
know, oh, nice.
Of course, you don't need to know what you're doing, or else you end up sewing yourself to it. I got them done very, very quickly, and I made them up in all sorts of cottons, all sorts of colors. And I just sent them to an industrial dyer who sent them all back to me black.
Oh, wow.
So it was the neatest thing ever. And the joke is, of course, that when I went to do Return of the Jedi, the first costume they tried me in before putting in that me into the green Imperial officer uniform was a black boiler suit with a black hat. And there's actually a picture of me up on my website. You can find it.
Oh, nice.
In my e-shop, there's a picture of me in my fitting in the costume that I actually made, which is a bit strange.
That is wild.
John and I then went on to do several films after that. I did Revolution with him, Al Pacino, and then we did Hornblowers together with Ewan Griffith. So, he was a lovely man. I would do anything he asked me to do. He was just such a sweet man.
Very cool.
But, so that was how I got involved in those costumes.
Wow. Neat.
Wow. So now you continue to do that. I mean, that is your career now, is with the costume shop and the theater group?
No, I'm retired now. I'm a revered senior citizen now. I'm 66. I've earned my time off. Thank you very much. I got my state pension here in England. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
And, the sewing machine's sitting there over there on a table. I can still throw something together if somebody needs it. Generally, I don't do any sewing anymore.
Oh, okay.
I did so much. So much.
Right. Gosh, wow. I can't imagine.
Wow.
And all. So when you were sitting there in the costume for Return of the Jedi and it all of a sudden rips, did your first thought go to, I could have made this better?
Not really. I just thought to myself, oh shit. They make me pay for it. I thought to myself,
right.
And I thought, that'd be silly. You didn't ask to put it on. So they'll have to.
Right. 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 Good call.
short microsecond of panic. So that probably came in, but not when I was delivering the line. That was acting.
Right. Wow. So in the Empire scene, were you on stage with David Prowse and Jeremy Bullock then?
Yes. Funnily enough, when I bumped into Dave Prowse on my first day in, he was fully costumed. And I didn't know that it was Dave Prowse. I'd never seen The New Hope. I didn't know anything.
Oh, wow.
I only knew about the bad reputation that George Lucas had in the industry in England for not being able to pay salaries, running out of money. And
Dave Prowse told a lot of stories about that.
Yeah. Then, glad it's not just me then. Then I saw a guy walk out of the wardrobe who I knew from years back. And his name was John Birkinshaw. John was an extraordinary character. He started as an extra in films and then ended up doing costuming. He couldn't sew to save his life, but he was a very good personal dresser. The only thing that any actor that worked with him had to understand and accept was that John was camper than a row of tents, and tended to an older man, and he tended to wear cashmere, especially pink cashmere, a lot of the time.
Oh.
Head to toe. Yes. And when he took on an actor to dress them, that actor became his property. And he came out and said, oh, Dave's in this costume, you know. I said, Dave? He said, yeah, Dave Prowse. I said, really? And Dave Prowse lifted his helmet. I said, I wouldn't do that. That looks like you're wearing something that surrounds your entire head underneath. He said, oh, yeah, I forgot that. So I said, well, nice to see you, Dave. I said, you might remember me from the gym down the old Kent Road. Uh-huh. The pub. He said, oh, yeah, I probably will recognize you, but I can't see you at the moment.
Right.
And John, or Mother, as he was known in the business, because he mothered his actors.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Great character. A really great character. No nastiness about him. He took me aside. He said, we've had a lot of problems with him because he can't see where he's going. I said, well, I can see that. I said, those lenses look absolutely pitch black. I said, worse than that. They said that they kept on seeing reflections in the lenses of the camera.
Oh, no.
Talking to them. So they asked me if I could do anything about it. I said, yes. I said, oh, good for you. So what do you do? He said, I got some Brasso, some polish, brass polish, abrasive brass polish, and I polished off the lenses. Well, I couldn't see any reflections, I said, and the problem of him walking into walls is to do with the fact that he couldn't see out anymore. I said, yes. So John, or Mother, as I'll continue to call him now, came up with a simple solution, basically. As I said, he used to mother his actors.
Right.
He literally coddled them and got them onto the stage, and they couldn't move without him being there, primping and moving everything around for continuity. And he lived near Shepperton Studios, which was just 15 miles away. And on his way home one evening, he dropped into Shepperton Railway Station and had a word with a porter who he knew very well because they used to go drinking together.
Okay.
So the porter on Shepperton Studios lent him a porter's trolley, one of those upright ones. It's just like an H with a step at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And he brought that into studio, and Dave was delivered to set on the back of the trolley. And Mother used to say, if there are anybody in the corridors, or as he turned into the stage, if there's anything in the way, I said, make way, daft Ada on her way through.
I bet David Prowse loved that.
I didn't do anything about it. So, yeah, he became known as Daft Ada. Eventually.
Oh, my gosh.
And Mother... Mother went on for years and years, worked for me on several films that I was designing. Unfortunately, in the end, booked himself into a monastery for a retreat one weekend and hanged himself.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, too bad.
And when Dave was told, he said, I'm not surprised. Lovely Dave.
Dave Prowse said that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Dave was not the all cuddly sort of person everybody thinks he was. He was quite single-minded about things.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. He put up with Mother because Mother got him onto the set in one piece. And because he was not to be seen in the corridors in the studio.
Okay.
With his helmet off. So people were not supposed to see him. He didn't realize why. He clearly had his contract that he was going to voice himself on the film.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that story. Yep.
And I remember them telling me about how they had to send him off to a second unit shot in the middle of a day, which was supposed to be all on him. because they actually had
the James face.
They had the face wearing a duplicate costume, and they were shooting his scenes while Dave was off doing second unit shots, which were never going to be used in the film.
Wow.
Oh.
Wow.
That, friends, is where the hatred arrived, can't speak English then, arrived between Dave Prowse and George Lucas. George Lucas just got fed up with Dave Prowse just telling anybody and everybody, even the newspapers, what the film was all about, how it went on, how the ending was.
Yeah, I remember that controversy.
Well, it went on long after that. Long after that. So that's why he got banned from Lucasfilm shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lucas tried to get him banned from any shows in America, which didn't work because promoters were much more cute than that. They knew that there was money to be had of having Dave Prowse there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everyone wanted to meet Dave Prowse. Yeah.
Well, he voted twice as the arch villain of all time in film.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So that didn't do his reputation any harm at all. So he turned up and he would literally clear the place of all money that was floating around. And when I used to do signings, and he used to be at a show, I did a show with him in Birmingham. And there were about 40 of us signing there. It's a big show. He insisted on sitting in the middle of all of us. And then he had them bring in metal fencing. So they fenced all of us off, and the only way to get to us was to go around the fencing and then down directly to Dave Prowse's table.
Oh.
Only after Dave Prowse had, did they turn left and right to see all of us. And I think I made about £1,000.
Wow.
First day. He made £40,000 on the first day. The first day. And then he cancelled himself for the second day because he'd got himself a great big fat offer to appear in another city in England. And he was going to go there and do the same.
Oh, wow.
So the organisers were mightily pissed off because they didn't.
I bet.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't he have a contract that he had to uphold? Don't they have contracts for that kind of stuff?
Not really.
Really?
Not really. It was a gentleman's agreement. You've got to be a gentleman to acknowledge it.
I'll bet that's not like that today at Comic-Con.
No. You've got to sign everything. When I went off to do official picks in Texas, the contract was like a film bloody contract. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And then I could only sign photos that they produced from their records for far worse quality than mine. And in the end, they have to say, okay, yeah, use your photos because these are crap. We've got them off of the original print. I say, well, which original print? And how many floors has it been scuttling along before you actually got your hands on it?
Oh, wow.
Absolutely rubbish. Photos are rubbish. I know I was out of focus on Return of the Jedi. And I know there's the problem with sound and everything else, but you couldn't even recognize the face as being me on a close-up.
Oh, dang. That came from official pics?
Yeah, from official pics. Because the only access they had to photos that weren't already released and therefore in the hands of the signers came off of the first print, first cinema print.
Okay.
So by the time I came to sign in in Texas, it was, about 2011, I think it was. First time I went over, and the photos they came up with were absolutely terrible.
Well, let's see, really in 2011 terrible. Would be after the special editions, which were, you know, enhanced colors and remastered, and you would think that they would have had
the
excellent.
The ones I have are absolutely fine. Not enhanced as such, but they just are clean.
Right.
Clean, and they are still out of focus, even on close-up. But you can actually see that it's me. You can recognize that I've got two eyes, a nose, and a big mouth.
Well, now, is that the same photo?
I was pouting like that.
Is that
what word I was saying at the time?
Oh, my gosh.
Is that the same photo that's used on Wikipedia?
Possibly. I don't know. I haven't looked at that picture for some time.
Okay. Because I think that's the one where you're looking up from the pit.
This is a what I call a clean one. This is slightly enhanced, and the color has been rectified. Let me see if I can get it there so you can see.
Yeah, that's the shot they use on Wikipedia. So yeah, that's a nice photo.
Yeah, that's a good looking one.
That's not the Lucasfilm one.
Wow. Well, you'd think Lucasfilm would have had the top, you know.
This is a Lucasfilm black and white.
Uh-oh.
I've got copies of it. I've never, ever signed it for anybody because nobody ever wanted it. I'll bring it in close. It's so black and dingy. Really nasty.
That's you behind Princess Leia there?
Yes, at that point, yes.
Cool.
Or is it Alan Austin, I ask? The truth is, we were on that for so long, we did get shifted around.
Sure.
Because every time they shifted the camera on this great wheel that we were working on,
they
would get crossovers, and people behind would then have to take two steps to the left, two steps to the right, to reappear out of the shadows of the person who was in foreground. And one guy actually walked off the edge of the set.
Oh, no.
Around with no handrails. So he went off. He was fine. He was absolutely fine. I mean, the costume was thin, extruded polyurethane. And it just literally shattered.
Oh, wow.
And he wasn't hurt. He was taken off to hospital. He came back again, in yet another costume.
Wow. Dang.
It was very dangerous. Very, very dangerous.
Yeah,
and the worst thing about the set also was that there was only one access point to the set. And it was a wide sweeping staircase that came up at the side. And it was being the only access to the set. The camera boys got in there, all their magazines and their lens stuff and, you know, stuff for the dolly, etc. It all got stacked onto these stairs. And then the makeup and the hair were in the background. And they were sort of propping themselves up and trying to stay out of the way, but there wasn't enough room.
Wow.
There are the lighting guys. You name it. Everybody was on these bloody stairs except us because we needed to get on the set and they just blocked it. So the answer was around the side of the set, they put up a double extension ladder, wooden ladder. And we had to go up with our stormtrooper outfits on, helmets in a hand or on, going up the ladder with one hand, one step at a time.
Oh, gosh.
To get up on the set. Yeah, it was a bit hairy, I have to tell you.
Wow.
Now, and this is the set that was like 100 and some odd degrees as well, with the steam or stuff too.
Yeah. I don't know what photos I've got here to hand.
Oh, my goodness.
Alan, I have to say, I thank you for your misery because that is one of my favorite scenes. I really appreciate the sweat and blood and tears that you put into that. Thank you very much.
I finally got out of it with the house, so I'm not complaining too much.
Right.
There's Henry VIII. Can you see?
Oh, cool. Okay.
Cod piece and all.
That's great. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
If there's any episode, I have to say, if there's any episode that we've done that we have to have it as video.
Oh, yeah.
Our listeners, this is the one.
This is it.
This is the one. Yeah.
Wow.
Special edition boys, and you can charge for it.
Right.
Well, we are talking about putting up stuff behind the paywall, so this may go on behind
Patreon,
the paywall.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, you can get them to come in and put in requests for me to come back and tell even more terrible, terrible secrets from the film. See how many more actors I can drag down with me.
I will say, I never thought this episode...
What was that?
Doing installments.
Oh,
I've got some Lulu stories. Believe me, I can tell stories that will have not even the actors blushing, but running for the hills if they ever came out. They say to me, "Oh, you've got such great stories. You get yourself in such terrible mixes." I say, "Well, it's because I never learned how to say no." So I do it. because you never know where your next piece of bread's going to come
from. Right, sure.
So yeah. I'd end up in terrible, terrible situations.
Wow.
I mean, without naming a film, here's a scenario for you. Could be true. It is, but I'm not going to put names to it. I was doing a war film. Now, anybody who goes on IMDb will find it. I was doing a war film, and one of the actors, quite young in one of his first films, but I'd worked with him on his very first film, we were shooting, no, I can't say that. We were shooting in an inaccessible area. Put it this way, we had to cross borders to get to it.
Oh, okay.
And it was very, very strict on the other side.
Okay.
And
yeah, we won't get you in trouble, no.
No. I don't care, shit anyway. And
Stephen
said help. You speak German. I said, yeah, I speak German. It's my first language. He said, oh, great. He said, I need you to go out and get me something. I said, what is it? He said, I've got crabs.
Uh-oh.
What? Crabs. I said, and you tell me that, and we're in an Eastern Bloc country? He said, well, I can't tell the production because they'll go mental. So I said, okay. So you've probably already worked out which country I'm talking about. I went out with two guards carrying Kalashnikovs who walked with me through the back streets of this city we were in.
Wow.
And I visited every chemist I could find. And I came back with a bucket of horrible white gunk.
Oh, no.
And I came back and I said, now you've got to tell me what you've been up to. Not because I'm going to tell everybody. but I need to know because we've got to get this under control. He said, well, I've been sleeping with blah. I said, okay. And blah. I said, aren't you engaged to her sister? He said, yeah.
Oh, no.
and the makeup artist. Uh-huh, and one of the assistants in the wardrobe.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, is that it? He said, oh, that's all the ones I want to admit to. Right, so before we start getting your costume into your trailer, you and I are going to go and knock on a few doors. Start on number two of the film, knock, knock, knock. I come in, I say, I'm sorry, but I have to have a rather intimate conversation with you.
Uh-oh.
Liam's behind me. He said, I'm sorry, baby. Saying, I'm terribly sorry. And I have to tell her that she's got to probably find she's got crabs. And I get a polystyrene cup and I sweep. I said, here is the solution. And what you do is you put it all over your body, wherever there's hair, even up here and in your eyebrows. And she's looking at me in absolute horror. I said, you leave it on for a while, as long as you can, because it burns, and then you wash it. And that should be it. If not, I've got a whole bucket load, and we can go over this again and do it at the end of the day.
Oh, my gosh. We went,
okay. And so she took the cup. We went out, knocked on the next door, the next actress. And then I went to the makeup trailer, and then I went back to my wardrobe. And I said, come here, young lady. And then the problems really started because he was in these uniforms and God knows what else. And stuntmen were sharing some of his costumes.
Oh, no.
Yes, originally. And what's more, even a couple of extras had worn them.
Oh.
In the second unit. Was.
Oh, my gosh.
So his entire wardrobe then had to go to dry cleaning whilst he was on stage, luckily in a suit that he hadn't worn.
He's practically starting a pandemic.
Yes. Grab City, here we come.
Right.
And I got all his costumes dry cleaned, and then I had to get them all broken down again so they looked like they were worn. And the same for the actresses. And it just became a major thing. Then finally the production got wind of it because I was putting in bills for dry cleaning that were coming out in thousands of dollars and not in tens
yeah,
of
right.
dollars.
Yeah, right.
It all came out on the film.
Yeah, well, and if your actor wasn't sleeping with everything that didn't move.
this was one of his problems. You know, he had big feet and big hands, and the girls couldn't resist him.
Right.
Typically, you know. And a similar thing happened on a BBC film in Bulgaria, of all places. The most ridiculous situation. We had English actors working on a historical movie for British TV about gunpowder treason and plot, Guy Fawkes blowing up Parliament, 1605 or thereabouts. And we end up in Bulgaria, where the men are so short and so puny that all the costumes I brought with me from England were huge on them. Absolutely huge on them. So they were swimming in these costumes. And one of the stunt masters, a Bulgarian, came up to me and he said, "I've got a problem." I said, "Oh, it's not crabs, is it?" He said, No. I've got a rash. Show me the rash, I said.
Rash. And it was okay.
It's like a circular rash. I said, "That looks to me like scabies."
Oh, no.
Yeah. He said, "What's scabies?" I said, "Let's go and see the nurse together."
Yeah, so no kidding.
She said, "Yeah, that's definitely scabies." I said, "So now we have to think about who has also been wearing your costume and whose costumes have you been wearing when you've been doubling?" And the list got longer and longer and longer and longer. And in the end, about 130 costumes had to be dry cleaned.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. And even the production office insisted on having sprays and lotions given to them just in case they touched anybody.
Right. Right. Oh, my
gosh. We got it all done. We didn't hold the production up a day, not even half a day.
Wow.
Wow. That's impressive.
Well, it cost a fortune.
Yeah.
I hope you've got insurance for scabies and things like that. I said, "Well, you're going to have to swallow the pride then and just tell the BBC accountants what really happened." They said, "No, we'll come up with a story along the way."
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, at least it wasn't crabs.
Well, these things happen, you know. Worst things happen at sea.
Boy, I never thought of... I never thought of the ordeals that people would go as a costume designer. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't believe it. Some things you just would not believe. I've had actresses who've come in and I said, I need to measure you. Fine. And they're standing there like this. I said, "Can you raise your arms? I need to get your overbust, your bust, and your underbust."
Right.
"And we're going to have to make a corset, so I have to do your midriff and your waist and also your high hip and your actual hip over your backside." Stand there like that. I said, "Look, you might as well tell me now what prosthetics you're wearing or what you've had put in, and I can deal with it."
Right.
You know, right.
Things that are out like this on a shelf that no corset in hell is ever going to tame.
Right.
Because they're rigged like, you know, game balls. They're just, like this. And they've got tucks in their tummy that they don't dare share with anybody. And bums plumped up and God knows what else. You just got to fight your way through it and say, "Look, if you want a costume, you want to look like $1 million, fine. If you want to look like $10, we'll try and dress you as you are now." So eventually they give in.
Right.
So there's nothing I haven't seen, I promise you.
Wow.
And it's true. On Revolution, we had an extra who had been cast locally in England, and he had just had a leg amputated.
Ooh.
And we had a scene which was one of the battle scenes during the American Revolution, and the director, Hugh Hudson, decided that he wanted to do a medical tent, and he'd cast an actor, a friend of his, to be a doctor. Well, if you know anything at all about doctors in the 1780s, 90s, they didn't actually use anesthetics.
Right, right.
They insisted on having someone who had had an amputation, and the word went out, and this guy turned up who was desperate because he'd been in hospital for a long time, and finally, he'd lost his leg, and now he was out, and there was this offer of money, and he desperately needed the money for his family. And his son was on the picture, too, dressed as an extra. So I said, "Fine, come to the wardrobe, I'll get you dressed up. I said, you do know what this entails, do you? I said to him. He said, well, no, not really. I said, what they're going to do is quite traumatic, or it can be quite traumatic. And they'll ask you to scream and shout and all sorts. They're looking at me with big saucer eyes, like a pair of crutches. I said, they have a prosthetic leg. And what they'll do is they'll trim it to fit your stump. He said, I haven't even had the dressings taken off since the operation yet.
Oh, wow.
So, well, we'll have to make sure that whatever costume we've got covers that amount. Because what he wants is the Surgeon General to cut off the leg on camera with blood bags inside the leg, splatter blood everywhere. And he's looking at me and the face is draining. I said, are you still up for this? I said, it could be really quite traumatic. And the assistant director behind me said, stop telling him all this. I said, you have to tell him this. You have to tell him this.
Right.
So anyway, I got him dressed up. They got him into a van, drove him out into the middle of a yellow rapeseed field, which is where they'd set up the tent. Strange place for a battle in a rapeseed field. But again, and this actor, Maxwell somebody or another, I can't remember his surname, he got stuck in on action. I mean, he was really gory. He was throwing blood in the air and all the rest of it. The guy had a heart attack and died.
Oh, my. Wow.
And they brought his body back to the wardrobe. And I said, he's dead. I said, yes, we need his costume. We found somebody else. So you need to dress another guy to replace him.
Dang.
And his son, who was in the scene as one of the revolutionaries, was standing there crying his eyes out, saying, I need to speak to my mom.
Yeah.
And all they were about was getting the costume off his dead father to get onto somebody else's body.
Wow.
You do see the world in the costume department, I can tell you.
Wow.
Yeah.
The show must go on, right?
I've had two or three people have died during this corporate filming. So.
Dang.
Yeah. Quite sad, really.
Sure, yeah.
But fascinating.
Wow.
Filming is a cutthroat business. They don't cut your throat. They'll find some other way of killing you off.
Right.
They're just an entity. They don't really care
right.
about you as a person.
Wow.
They'll take your cod piece.
Oh, no, I'd scream blue murder if they took my cod piece off me. So there you go.
Well, not if they're hauling you away dead, you won't.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Right.
Of course, you could do the Monty Python scene. I'm not dead yet.
Yeah. Or I could be the knight with no arms and no legs.
Right. Right. It's just a flesh wound.
I've had worse.
Go again.
can you tell we're Monty Python fans?
Oh, yeah. Oh my goodness.
I did Wind in the Willows with them.
You did what?
It was great film, Wind in the Willows with the Python team.
Oh, I don't think I know that one.
Oh, it's great. It's not the best film, but it's great.
Okay. So you got to work with John Cleese then?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Terry Jones was directing, so... we had quite realistic animal costumes in Winds and the Willows. The designer was a very, very talented, I was going to say drug addict, but of course I didn't mean to say that. Very talented designer who had an incredible imagination. And so the costumes were brilliant on the film, and it was quite a film. Really was, but it wasn't that successful, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah, Wind in the Wind.
I might have to look that up.
You know, I did pull up the IMDb page in looking at it and stuff. So, so you worked on the movie Ronin.
Yes.
How did you like doing that?
Another frank expose. Well, De Niro was...
what an episode!
Do tell, sir.
Pain in the ass from day one. He arrived late to the set. He was supposed to come in earlier. And John Frankenheimer was directing, who is a Frankophile, or was a Frankophile. He's dead now. But he thought that he spoke fluent French, so he insisted that everybody who worked on the film had to speak French. He'd have all the production meetings in French, and the problem was his French was so execrable that even the French couldn't understand him. And then it translated to him having nightly meetings in his trailer. Well, heads of department alone, plus the accountants, came to around about 80 people on that film, because it was such a huge film. So we ended up, I usually ended up outside with a glass against the side of the trailer, trying to pick up words. And if I heard the word wardrobe, I said, standing by! And then they'd feed out whatever he was saying, or what they could understand him saying. And even though I was on it, and my designer, lovely, lovely lady called May Routh, who lives in LA, even though we both spoke French pretty well, he and I, Frankenheimer and I, were English, but I didn't dare speak a word of English because he would lose his temper and start throwing things if he heard the words of an Englishman speaking.
But talk about
Americans. The production assistant on it was an American, and he could speak to Frankenheimer in English. He was an American.
Because he was American.
Frankenheimer hated the English.
Wow.
As we were just working in France, just to hop over the channel, it was a bit difficult. So I had two of my staff in the wardrobe were from England, but lived in Paris, and married and had families and lived in Paris. And the third one was an American girl who'd been a model and had settled in Paris too. So we all spoke French better than John Frankenheimer, who had learned French when he'd had a nervous breakdown in the late 50s. Doing an American TV series and fled the country, ended up in Paris, bummed around, and then got a job working in a restaurant. And he had a flair for cooking, so they took him on as a sous chef. And then he ended up finally working in the Tour d'Argent. And the Tour d'Argent is a restaurant, very chichi, at the top of the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, wow.
So it's five-star dining. And that's where he learned his French. Anyway.
For our audio listeners, Alan just made a pucker of a face. It was great.
Yeah. Pucker that looks like an asshole. But I shouldn't say things like that. And anyway, De Niro turned up late, and we got him in on the first day after the first fittings, which were painful for me. Because he was such, he was difficult to be difficult.
Oh, wow.
Really difficult. For instance, I had bought him Levi's to wear for a lot of the film. So he's supposed to be an agent undercover who joins up with this international gang of thieves, etc.
It's actually one of my favorite spy movies. I've always enjoyed that film.
Well, look at his jeans when you see him, because he's wearing 501s.
Okay.
Where I had to change the label to 505, and I had to take the jeans, take out the zip, and put in buttonholes.
Button fly?
A button fly. So I said, why don't I just buy you 505s? No, they don't fit right. 501s fit me perfectly. So in the end, I was buying in 505s, which I just ripped some of the stitching, and then I stitched back by hand, so it looked like it wasn't quite right. He said, yeah, okay, I'll wear those. And he got away wearing them. Anyway, he went on with this stuff. The very first day of shooting, he stayed in his trailer and refused to come out. So the ADs were there saying, can you go in? I said, no, he's got a makeup and hair person who is in there, who is like, well, she's like a cougar, basically. Fearful woman. I'd worked with her before when she'd worked with Sean Connery on a film.
Oh, wow.
And she was a first-class cow, to be basic. And I said, well, we need him out on the set. I said, well, he's refusing to come out. I said, you need to get Frankenheimer down here to speak to him. And then, oh, what's the name of that producer who ended up in jail? Touching up women. You know which one it is. Ugliest Sin.
Weinstein?
He was our producer.
Oh.
He was our producer. Yeah.
Okay.
He was our producer, and he came down with Frankenheimer, and they went into the trailer, and finally they came out and said, he's getting dressed now. I said, great. Says, we're not going to have this every day. Says, no, not if it costs me another $1 million.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez.
He'd arrived, and he didn't have access to any of his accounts. He was wanted by the police in France, so he wanted to stay undercover as much as possible. So we had to black out all around his trailer, and his makeup artist had to have another trailer adjoining. So there was a tunnel that he'd go backwards and forwards. And if the police came, they were to be stalled while he was spirited away in a car and taken somewhere else.
Wow.
So this went on for the whole duration of the film. So that was a real piss take on the rest of us. We were working our butts off trying to get this, you know, multi-million dollar film sorted. And he just carried on like this. And he came up with this wonderful, wonderful blast of an idea that anything he touched on camera that appeared on the screen that he touched belonged to him. Which was not a problem most of the time. But nobody, unfortunately, on, I think, about the sixth day, had explained that to the French prop master. Robert De Niro wrote himself into a scene, and John Frankenheimer never said no to Bol. So sure. He went to the back of a set, and in the foreground, there was the girl, whose name I can't remember, and Jean Reno. And they're talking between the two of them, and he's observing them from the other side of the building, basically on the same floor. And he stood there doing a crossword. You'll see him. He's folded a paper four ways, and he's just doing a crossword.
Right.
Uh-huh. He needed a pen. He needed a pen, so he said to the prop man, "J'ai besoin d'un stylo." He spoke enough French to say, "I want a biro." So the guy went, "Oh, okay," and pulled one out and gave it to him. So De Niro went, scene went on all day, that scene. And finally, at the end of the day, the prop man went to get his pen back, and De Niro refused to give it to him. And he was apoplectic with anger, the prop man, because the pen he'd lent De Niro was a gold pen that had been given him by Johnny Hallyday.
Oh, wow.
One of France's greatest stars. Who had done, and therefore this was a very sentimental thing for the prop man, who had done lots of films with Johnny Hallyday, and De Niro wouldn't have anything. He refused to give it. Everything that he touched at the end of the day went into Ziploc pockets, which were then sealed with vacuum, and then they were packaged and sent to his warehouse in New York.
Oh my gosh.
They were then sent to various restaurants, which he had part ownership in, to be displayed on the walls as decor, and which he sold for celebrity auctions when he was down to his last million or whatever. So we had this all the way through. And at the end of the day, I had found a leather jacket, which I tried on him, not on camera. I said, this is a great jacket. You can't wear this one, but if you like it, I will get it copied faithfully. You will not be able to tell the difference. And he put it on. He said, I love it. I said, but you can't have it because you need to have doubles. Got a lot of destruction, shootings, killings, burnings, stabbings, car chases, all that crap that's going on.
Right.
Remember that, Bob. You need to have doubles, so you can't have this one. Yeah. So I'll take it back now. So basically got it off his back. It had been made for James Dean.
Wow.
It had James Dean's name inside it.
Wow. Inside
it. Come the end of the film, I had all six doubles made. Beautifully made. So there's a stitch, you can tell the difference. They're all identical. He didn't even realize I was putting six different jackets on him during the film. That's how out of it he was most of the time. And by the end of the film, he had decided to take all the jackets and pack them up and send them off to America. And so he and his assistant had packed box after box after box after box of stuff. And whilst they had a production party, during the afternoon, I went with my assistants, and we emptied box after box after box after box and filled it with all sorts of crap. It doesn't matter if you're De Niro, don't cross me.
Right.
I love it. That's awesome. You know, I don't think he could have got away with that on Star Wars, because George Lucas kept everything.
He did. Every single piece of broken armor ended up, if you find the picture, if you go to my e-shop on the net.
Okay.
There's alanfling.weebly.com.
Okay.
And then, or it might be co.uk, I can't remember. Have a look and go and find that picture of me dressed in the black jumpsuit outfit, because it's there.
That's the undersuit for the stormtrooper suit?
No, it's the black Death Star episode.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, sure. I think Steven's trying to pull it up now.
I am trying to pull it up, yeah.
I'm sorry, what was it? He's pulling it up now. At least he's trying to.
I can't remember if it's co.uk or .com. It's Weebly.
It's, well, I got alanfling.weebly.com/eshop.html.
Yeah. Is that the one you've... Is it coming up as an error?
You're talking about number 13 Polaroid of Death Star officer?
That's it. Now, if you look at that photo closely, you'll notice that I'm standing there with this black hat on sideways, which didn't fit me. And
here we go. I got it up on the screen.
Right. Oh, nice. Okay.
Up to my right, that's my arm that's bent, above me, there's a whole shelf of black helmets. They're all Darth Vader helmets.
Oh, wow.
The man kept on busting helmets like mad all the time, walking things into stanchions, into scaffolding, you know. he could find anything. He would have been a great metal detector, human metal detector. But if you look behind me, there's a window. You can see the side of a window. Stacked up in that window behind me are broken pieces of stormtrooper armor. Every single piece, even if it was just a corner that broke off, they were all collected and they were kept, all to be packaged and all to be sent to the ranch.
Wow.
So all of those things are still there.
That's so cool.
It was a constant battle to try and find enough costume to put on people when we were doing sort of rudimentary stunt stuff, because the stunt guys were often on the first unit doing main action stuff, so we idiots were sent off to the back to do stunt work, which we weren't qualified to do, you know, like falling down with pew 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 down the corridors and falling down, smashing the back piece or anything just broke off because it was so brittle.
Right. Wow.
Very thin, very very thin, and every single piece, and that's what's in that photo basically. Because that's in the back room off of the set.
Wow, cool.
Who knew? Who knew? I was like, man, we got all kinds of background. Say that again, I'm sorry.
So you didn't dare, if you broke something or cracked something, you didn't tell anybody. You went and got some gaffer tape off of the camera guys. and then you just put gaffer tape on, which was fine. And everybody got away with that. So many outfits were repaired with white gaffer tape, camera tape.
Wow.
The trouble was, as soon as George then had yet another bright idea in the reincarnations of Star Wars a la George Lucas' imagination, when he finally put out an HTML version, no, high definition version, you could see all the gaffer tape suddenly. So if you've got a copy of Empire Strikes Back, which is in high definition, that edition, you can see everywhere. You can see black gaffer tape, white gaffer tape, all over the place. Yeah.
Wow.
We were rattling with it.
I'm so gonna look.
Oh my gosh.
This is something really, really, really interesting. When we were lining up shots in the carbonite chamber on Empire Strikes Back, the first few days of that, the special effects guys were coming up the ladder, and they were coming up with safety stuff because they had to turn off gas, turn off the jets of steam, etc., to be able to work on stuff. In the end, they just left them on 24 hours a day. But they came up at one point because we had lined up a shot which was just Boba Fett, Ralph Morse, which is another extra, Boba Fett and Darth Vader and me. Just the four of us. And it was all lined up, ready to shoot. And then at the last minute, the director said, no, open up the shot. I want to see the whole width of the shot. The problem was that the two guys who were on safety duty had come up the ladder and they come up with two fire extinguishers.
Okay.
Red fire extinguishers. Now, you cannot mistake a red fire extinguisher, especially in a scene where it's not supposed to be.
Right.
And if you look once again, on, if you've still got the page up with my shop on, you'll find the photo of the wide shot and Billy Dee Williams is in the foreground leaning over Han Solo in carbonite, and I'm at the back. Yeah, you find that shot right in the middle, center back. In the middle, there are two fire extinguishers. Got shot on because nobody got the.
Okay, I found it. I found it here.
Okay, yeah, you got to share this. I got to see this. Okay.
Right there.
Billy Williams.
Oh, right, yeah. There.
Two fire extinguishers that didn't belong there. So oh, they ended up.
Wow.
And there's another shot of me and Darth Vader and Boba Fett, just the three of us, which is an upright photo.
Now, which one are you in this one? Is this you right here or to the right?
I'm over on the right-hand side.
Okay. This one here?
Yeah. You can see I'm standing in all the steam.
Yeah.
Yep.
I got that first position given to me, which I was in a lot of the time, day in, day out.
Oh, my goodness.
They came up to switch off the jets because I was complaining that I was getting scolded. And they came up with a monkey wrench, steel monkey wrench, to turn off the valves.
That one?
And then in the end, as I said, they just gave up coming up and switching off the steam. We just had to be burnt and put up with it. One of them had come up with his nice bright steel monkey wrench and put it down at my feet. And you know what? That stayed there until we finished filming the scene. It starts off as bright silver. You can actually see it in some of the shots. Oh. And by the end of it, it's rust, pure rust.
Wow. Wow. Dang.
It became my marker. They said, well, you can't take it away because it's established. It's on camera now. It's in the scene.
Right.
People don't know what it is. But I knew what it was.
Yeah.
Right. What's the second picture you were referencing?
It's a three shot of me, Boba Fett, and Darth Vader.
Okay.
From the same sequence. It's just the three of us. It's an upright picture as opposed to landscape. That's...
It would be...
You're lucky you didn't trip over that.
That's right. And just if you look down at the bottom...
Oh, nice.
Go to the corner and move in about an inch. If you can imagine what an inch is. Oh, there you are.
There it is.
There it is.
That's wow.
The spanner. The spanner in the works.
I
had to say that then.
I said the hydro spanner. So how was Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher on set? What were they like?
Carrie was very nice. She was very chatty with people. Most of us knew not to bother them, obviously.
Sure.
Because she had emotions to get through. And she was highly professional. Highly professional. And, all of them were pretty good, actually, except for Harrison.
Harrison
was pretty antisocial most of the time. He got very quiet and introverted, and he had a little shed that the prop men had brought onto the stage and put in the corner of the stage where they used to keep stuff. And he used to go in there to get away from everybody. He'd go in there and he'd shut the door And that was his little quiet space. And sometimes it was very difficult to get him out of there when they needed him. But he didn't like to stand around. He didn't chat with people. He wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not that any of us wanted to chat with him, to be honest, you know, because he always had this look of angst on his face.
That sounds so Harrison Ford. That just sounds like him.
Yeah, so get away from me, kid.
It was fine by us. It was fine by us. You know, we didn't give a toss, really, to be honest. Everybody else was lovely. Peter Mayhew was lovely.
I bet Peter was great.
Maybe not the golden droid. He was a little bit up himself.
Anthony Daniels.
I think he still is a bit up himself. But then you never know. He never chatted to any of us either. He was in his own little world.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, okay. Did you ever get to meet Kenny Baker then?
Oh, yes. Kenny was lovely.
Yeah, because, you know, Kenny really and Anthony, they didn't get along at all.
No, couldn't bear each other. Could not bear each other.
Which is so funny because they're supposed to be like, you know, for droids, they're supposed to be like the best of friends, you know, and the two of them couldn't stand each other.
Kenny had a really difficult passage on that film, because that droid, which they actually put him into,
right,
was really, really tight and tiny, even for him. And he used to sweat buckets inside it.
Oh.
I can't imagine what it was like when they went to Tunisia and into the desert. But,
well, I heard a rumor that one of the scenes, I forget which movie it was, but there was one of the scenes that they all broke for lunch and left him there in the suit.
That wouldn't surprise me. That wouldn't surprise me.
Oh, my gosh.
It really wouldn't surprise me. It happened to me on a film once. I was left up in the air, suspended up in the air. It was on Spaceman in King Arthur's Court.
Oh.
I was suspended from a tree, and I was just hanging there. They all broke their lunch, and I was still there when they came back. I said, "Where's Alan?" I said, "Up here." I hope you brought me a sandwich.
I hope you all had a nice lunch.
You're right. Oh, holy cow, man. I've just looked at the time. We have gone way over our normal time. We got like another double episode action.
Yeah,
it
sounds
on.
Like it.
Alan, this has been fantastic.
Yes.
This has been wonderful. Just your stories are just intriguing and fascinating, even behind the scenes.
Believe me, you've only just scratched the surface.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
well, we'll have
goodness.
To have you back on again. This has been great.
This has been fun.
Anytime. Just make sure they're not burying anybody in the castle. I'm a sucker for a good funeral.
Right.
Well, let's hope that the queen lasts quite a while, so.
Well, bless her. And she's, what, 94 now?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's what
mother
I hear, yeah.
101, and she's healthier than her mother was at 100, 94 years of age. So she might well go on. You never know.
Philip made it to 99?
99 for Philip, right?
Yeah, 2 months and 4 days short of his 100th birthday.
Oh, too bad he didn't make it to 100. That would have been great.
Yeah, they were trying to nurse him through it, but in the end, you know, they let him out of the hospital because it was pointless keeping him in, to be honest. He wants to be back with his family.
If he would have made it to 100, would they have thrown like a huge celebration for the country, or what would have happened?
Probably not. No, we're not like that.
Okay.
Just be on the news. His Royal Highness attained the age of 100 today. And in other news.
No big deal.
Celebrating it for royalists, it'll be, you know, a couple of weeks afterwards it'll be out. No, they're not like that on British TV.
Oh, okay. All right.
So they're very deferential about the Queen and the family, etc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting.
Sad he died just short of his, he wanted 100. He always said he did.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's too bad he didn't make it.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. He's now playing a harp, so.
Right.
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 Mr. Indiscreet hits again.
Wow.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Well, Alan, this has been fantastic. Absolutely enjoyable. Thank you so much. Yeah, we have to have you back on. Just these behind the scenes kind of stories are just your illustrious career. I don't think a lot of people realize yes, you were in Star Wars movie, but just the costuming history that you have, all the stuff that you've done behind the scenes and all the hard work it takes to make these films, you just kind of unveiled for us.
Yeah, this has been fascinating.
We're the nobodies behind the camera that never get celebrated. Even when they do the Oscars night, they don't show the awards being given out to the costume, the makeup, etc., because they're ancillary.
That's true.
Right. Yep.
That is true. Well, but, sincerely, go ahead.
Films where my designer has picked up an Oscar and I've been named on stage for it, so I can't complain.
Yeah,
I've got awards from other places anyway, so they mean nothing. They just take up space.
Sure, right. Dust collectors, right?
Right. That's excellent. Well, Alan, sincerely, thank you so much for being with us. This is our special May the 4th Be With You podcast, and we really... sincerely, thank you so much for being with us. This was a lot of fun.
Yes, thank you.
You're really welcome. I've enjoyed myself. Both of you, great. Great fun. Thank you.
All right.
Yep. All right. Well, Mike, you want to sign us out for today?
Yes. Since, again, we have another friend from across the pond, like we did with Paul Bateman the other week, I'm going to just bid us cheers and play our outro. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today on the Two Geeks and a Microphone podcast. Tune in next week when we will have more news and reviews. Until then,
may the Force be with you.